One of the things I like to do is read poems that are favorites of mine, and maybe they're favorites of yours. So I'll read a few, and if you have any requests, you can always throw out one. I brought tons of books. I probably find it in here somewhere. Does that sound all right? Okay. I think to start with, I'm going to ask somebody, would you shut the door on your way in through there? Yeah, thanks. Quieter the better. Since they've had this Hiroshima thing today, I thought I might start with Jesse Jackson's in there. Poems are here.
You're a receptionist.
I think, yeah.
A question, Jack.
Yeah.
When you pick my favorite poems,
yeah.
What makes a favorite poem for you?
What I like.
Yeah.
When
you drink wine that way too, I know, but.
What I used to, things you're comfortable with, yeah. Certain sounds, a lot of Robert Frost, some Tennyson, some D.H. Lawrence, Yeats, just people that have become old friends. I think their poems wear well with
them. Is there any poem, when you first read it, that you say, hey, I don't want this one? It'll never be my favorite.
Oh, sure. Yeah, most probably. Yeah, most of Wallace Stevens, for example. Most of T.S. Eliot. Most people. It's like Friends, I think. You know, you sort of winnow it down pretty fast. And I think if you go through life having two or three close friends, I think you're pretty well off. I think if you can come out with just a handful of poems that are comfortable, they're pretty well off too. Somebody once said, I don't know who, that a poet should be satisfied if he can leave six first-rate poems behind him. Well, that's not much if you write hundreds and hundreds or thousands of poems. Six first-rate. But I think it's probably true. You literally have to write probably hundreds or thousands in order to come up with those six, five, seven, whatever number. It takes a bunch of garbage to get the good.
We have to get the agreement on who does the reading.
There you go. That's why we need critics, right? I thought I'd start with that poem by Thomas Merton, since we had the Hiroshima thing. Thomas Merton, I hope to do a session on Merton sometime next week. Merton, if you're not familiar with him, was a Catholic Trappist monk who lived for 27 years in a monastery in an abbey in Kentucky. And he was a Cistercian monk, is very a hard life. He had, of course, the vow of the rest of the celibacy and all that that the other monks take. They had the vow of silence. And the brothers talk a little now. Some of them don't like to talk. I spent a week's retreat down there last year and went through their schedule, getting up at 3:15 in the morning, praying the various hours, and going to bed at 8:30. And they spent a lot of time in choir, a lot of time chanting the office, in addition to which 4 hours of manual work, not to mention if they write or whatever else they happen to do. So it's a heck of a strenuous life. Merton was there for 27 years and managed to publish over 50 or 60 books. Now here's a monk that's supposed to be quiet, and somehow he managed to say more than most people who don't have that particular vow. And in the 60s, he became very vocal in his way through his journals about the peace movement and the Vietnam War. And his things were censored for a time by the Catholic Church. But then after a year or two, after the Berrigan brothers got in trouble for burning draft cards and peace strikes and marches and all that sort of stuff, the censors relented and published his work, and he became a leading voice from the peace movement. But that has nothing really to do with what I'm talking about. I just got talking on Merton. But this poem called For My Brother, Reported Missing in Action, 1943, Merton was converted to Catholicism, just bang like that pretty much, and his brother joined the Canadian Air Force, although they're both Americans, and was going overseas, and he wanted to visit his brother Tom, who was called Father Louis, or Louis, in the monastery. So he came and spent a few days at the monastery. Merton talked to him, he read other books, and was baptized a Catholic before he left the monastery, and then ultimately went overseas and died in action. So this is a poem called called for. My brother reported missing in action. I thought it might be apt in this discussion of Hiroshima. Sweet brother, if I do not sleep, my eyes are flowers for your tomb. And if I cannot eat my bread, my fast shall live like willows where you died. If in the heat I find no water for my thirst shall turn to springs for you, poor traveler. Where, in what desolate and smoky country lies your poor body, lost and dead? And in what landscape of disaster has your unhappy spirit lost its road? Come, in my labor find a resting place, and in my sorrows lay your head. Or rather take my life and blood and buy yourself a better bed. Or take my breath and take my death and buy yourself a better rest. When all the men of war are shot and flags have fallen into dust, your cross and mine shall tell men still Christ died on each for both of us. For in the wreckage of your April, Christ lies slain, and Christ weeps in the ruins of my spring. The money of whose tears shall fall into your weak and friendless hand and buy you back to your own land. The silence of whose tears shall fall like bells upon your alien tomb. Hear them and come. They call you home. Merton was a very, very fine poet and has a huge collected works, collected poems. If you have not read Thomas Merton, I would suggest you start with his autobiography, Seven Story Mountain. I better get off Merton. I'm liable to start doing my Merton talk. But it's hard not to talk about, because I think every now and then you come across somebody who changes you in some ways, you know, whether it be somebody you're holding or somebody you read or whatever. Merton was that for me. I think there have been three or four things that have jarred my life out of a certain road and into another road. Holden Village was one of those jarring things. Merton was certainly another. I read his autobiography called Seven Story Mountain about, I don't know, 25 years ago or whatever, and I wrote to him, being a fairly impulsive sort, and I said, "Dear Thomas Merton, I read your book. I like it a bunch," or some silly thing. And I got a letter back from the abbot saying, "Father Lewis cannot write to you. I hope you understand," which, of course, being a hard-bitten Protestant, I didn't understand. They're only allowed to write four letters a year and then only family. That, too, is let up. Merton saw to that after 50 books. Abbott said, what are we doing with this fellow? And he said, "I assure you Father Lewis is happy." And blah, blah, blah. Sent me a nice brochure on the Trappist monastery. I'll never forget the ending of his letter said, "All for love through Mary with a smile." I thought that was very nice. For Missouri Synod Lutheran, I thought that was sort of artsy-craftsy, but I liked it. So anyway, that was 25 years ago, and I sort of dwelled on that. And then I reread it years ago, and then all of a sudden something clicked, and I started reading Merton, and I've read everything that I could get my hands on. So you ought to start with Seven Story Mountain. And then read The Sign of Jonas next. That's a journal he kept the first 5 years in the monastery. If you ever had any idea or questions about what a monastery might be like, maybe you haven't had any questions. I always was sort of fascinated. What kind of a man or woman would go into a place like that and close the doors? Even the monks refer to it as behind the wall. When I was down there, there's one person celebrating his 50 years behind the wall. Sounds like you're in prison, but not at all. They go out jogging and they tend the fields and all that good stuff, and they all, I mean, there's much, much happiness going on there. Good stuff. And great bread they make, cheese. Okay, enough of Merton. Well, maybe not all. I'll think of something else to say. How about, let's start with a couple of poems by Robert Frost. How would that be? Since he's pretty much my favorite American poet. Something that everybody knows, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. You all remember that. It's anthologized to death, but deservedly so, I guess. It's a good poem. "Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep." And I'm sure you all know that controversy, not controversy, but when one critic asked Frost why he repeated the last line, Frost said, "I like the sound of it." And the critic said, oh no, that's not it at all. Frost says it's not. Critic says, oh no. Frost says, well then why did I do that? He said, well, that's a death wish. And he proceeded to go through how the cold and the horse represented this, and the sleigh represented, like Emily Dickinson's sleigh, because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me, that sort of thing. And Frost listened right away. He says, that's why I wondered why I wrote that. Frost didn't have much use for critics. Most writers don't have a whole bunch of use for them. There have been a few writers over the years who have been good critics. I think that's a rarity. Mark Van Doren may be one of the very best. If you don't know the works of Mark Van Doren, you might pick up his. They used to have his book here in the village, little paperback, 100 poems. Just a very fine poet. Lived in Cornwall Hollow, Connecticut. He's an excellent critic. Thomas Merton's an excellent critic. Others have been. T.S. Eliot, in some ways. Anyway, a few years back, I did an interim here in January with 15 kids from CLC, where I teach in Southern California, and 15 from PLU, and we all met in Seattle and came over Stevens Pass in a bus, and we were doing a class called The Nature of Creativity, which was team taught with a poet and an artist and a musician and then Gordon Cheesewright, a buddy of mine who just came along because the psychologist was sick, so we never did figure out what Gord was doing. But he was sleeping on the way over the pass, and I was looking out the window. You know how it's dark and the lights are on, you kind of see yourself more than anything else, the reflection, and I could see these heavy boughs with snow out there, and it was just gorgeous. And this line ran through my mind, the woods are lovely, dark, and deep. And as if the first time I'd ever understood what that line meant. And I grabbed Gord, I said, Gord, he said, what? I said, the woods are lovely, dark, and deep. He said, I know, but Frost already said it. Good old Gord. How about The Road Not Taken? You remember that one? Mm-hmm. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveling. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. I think Frost has a way of saying things like that better than anybody that I've ever come across. He has a facility for saying things that rhyme, first of all. In fact, he said, writing poems without rhymes like playing tennis without a net. He didn't take, free verse was not for Robert Frost. I think the closest he came, he wrote some blank verse. Death of a Hired Man, of course, is just beautiful stuff, but he wouldn't free verse. In fact, he had that facility. It was so strong in him that there's a story. One night he was having dinner with some Jesuit priests, and they were talking on either side of him about free will and sin and predestination, all kinds of heavy theological issues. And they got on original sin. They were going back and forth, and they had charts and graphs, and they were spouting Aquinas and Augustine and all the church fathers. And they turned to him and said, what do you, as a poet, think about original sin, Mr. Frost? And between drinks of his red wine and slurps of his spaghetti, he said, it's from their having stood contrasted that good and bad so long have lasted. And the priests looked at each other and said, well, I guess we'll shut up and enjoy the spaghetti now. That's sort of put it in the context. You know. It's from their having stood contrasted that good and bad so long have lasted. It's not that, is it?
It's almost good enough to be Arthur Nash.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Nash would find some way to spice it up, I suppose. Here's one of my favorite poems for us called Reluctance. Maybe you know this poem. Only four stanzas. Out through the fields and the woods and over the walls I've wended. I have climbed the hills of view and looked at the world and descended. I have come by the highway home, and lo, it is ended. The leaves are all dead on the ground, save those that the oak is keeping, to ravel them one by one and let them go scraping and creeping out over the crusted snow when others are sleeping. And the dead leaves lie huddled and still, no longer blown hither and thither. The last lone aster is gone. The flowers of the witch hazel wither. The heart is still aching to seek, but the feet question, whither? Ah, when to the heart of man was it ever less than treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with a grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love or a season? I think that last stanza is maybe Frost at his very best. You know, he said a poem should begin in delight and end in wisdom. You know, that's mighty tough to do if you write. You know what that is? It's tough to begin anything delightfully. It's tough to begin. But to begin it, if you're lucky enough to begin something, is delightful. And then to somehow along the way, you shift gears philosophically and you wind up with a universal truth. That's just all but impossible to do. When you try to do that, you usually come out with the worst possible doggerel. And you nail your thumb with the theses right to the door when you should be saying something briefly and then leaving it for the reader to come to. So you don't have to explain everything. Frost manages to do that better than any other poet. Listen to that last stanza again. Ah, when to the heart of man was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with a grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love or a season? If you have any questions or you want to make comments as we go along, feel free. This is a relaxed thing, I think. If you want to say anything. Here's a poem by Mark Van Doren, since I mentioned him, called Sleep, Grandmother. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The rocking horse is ready to go, and harness bells are hung in a row, as once you heard them, in soft snow. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. Your sons are little and silly again. Your daughters are 5 and 7 and 10, and he that is gone was not gone then. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The sleigh comes out of the winter's woods and carries you all in boots and hoods to town for candy and white dress goods. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The rocking chair is old as the floor, but there he stands at the noisy door for you to be dancing one dance more. Mark Van Doren wrote some interesting things, short stories, poems, a lot of criticism, and some good fiction. So if you don't know him, you might want to pick him up sometimes. Very good. Anybody from Connecticut in there? I always ask that every time I read this poem. How about something by Longfellow? You like Longfellow? The day is done. Remember that one? The day is done, and the darkness falls from the wings of night as a feather is wafted downward from an eagle in its flight. I see the lights of the village gleam through the rain and the mist, and a feeling of sadness comes over me that my soul cannot resist. A feeling of sadness and longing that is not akin to pain, and resembles sorrow only as the mist resembles the rain. Come read to me some poem, some simple and heartfelt lay, that shall soothe this restless feeling and banish the thoughts of day. Not from the grand old masters, not from the bard sublime, whose eloquent footsteps thunder through the corridors of time. For like strains of martial music, their mighty thoughts suggest life's endless toil and endeavor, and tonight I long for rest. Read from some humbler poet, whose songs gushed from his heart, as showers from the clouds of summer or tears from the eyelids start. When through long days of labor and nights devoid of ease, still heard in his soul the music of wonderful melodies. Such songs have power to quiet the restless pulse of care and come like the benediction that follows after prayer. Then read from the treasured volume the poems of thy choice and lend to the rhyme of the poet the beauty of thy voice. And the night shall be filled with music, and the cares that infest the day shall fold their tents like the Arabs and as silently steal away. Longfellow's mighty good, especially if you like rhythm, if you like rhyme. You can get too much rhythm and rhyme with Longfellow, I suppose, if you have to sit through a whole evening of long of Hiawatha. It says, by the shore, I get you goomy, dwelt the wigwam of Nokomis. After about 1,000 lines of that, you begin to yearn for little Dylan Thomas pre-verse. But he's awfully good. A graduate professor I had, who should remain nameless, at the University of Nebraska, once said, we're going to do Longfellow in this course that I had. And he said, we'll only do a couple of poems because you know he's passé. And that got my Irish up in a hurry. I don't like immediately people dismissed because someone says they're passé. Who decides? As Harry said, what's good is passé. I think you ought to just read tons of Longfellow and let us decide if he's passé. If we don't like him, we'd read somebody else. But I had a problem in graduate school that way. And I don't think he's the least bit passé. I like him a lot. But he's not taught a whole bunch in schools anymore. I have to put on my glasses so I can read this stuff. It's getting... The Xerox machine at CLC is no better than the one at Holden Village. Maybe worse. Okay, A Psalm of Life. By the way, this is in, I think, about 1928 or 30 or thereabouts, newspapers of America had a contest, asked the readers to write in and say, what's your favorite poem? Can you imagine newspapers doing that today? New York Times or the Washington Post or... What's your favorite poem, America? Sad to say, I don't think they wouldn't ask it, and I don't know what kind of response they might get. But this is the one that was judged America's favorite poem when they did it in 1928. It's got real Victorian pizzazz. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow finds us further than today. Art is long and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still like muffled drums are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not like dumb driven cattle, be a hero in the strife. Trust no future, however pleasant, let the dead past bury its dead. Act, act in the living present, heart within and God o'erhead. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother seeing shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. That does have a great Victorian ring to it, doesn't it? Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, onward with life, and all that kind of stuff.
Was that another Longfellow?
Yeah, Longfellow. It's the same kind of thing that Edgar Lee Masters picked up, that same tone when he wrote Spoon River Anthology, with all the people coming back from the grave and talking. There's a great one in there, I think it's Lucinda Matlock's poem. She says she lived to be 96 and had all kinds of sons and daughters. And then the last of the poem, she says, what is this I hear of people griping and complaining about life? She says, degenerate sons and daughters, life is too tough for you. She says, it takes life to love life. It's a great kind of ringing huzzah, you know, like Carl Sandburg's, say, the people, yes. There's usually, generally speaking, two avenues of poetry in America. One is very negative and tends to be hard to read, hard to understand. The other tends to be very positive and simpler. And on the positive side, you have people like Carl Sandburg, Robert Frost for the most part, William Carlos Williams. On the other side, it really comes from the French poets, Baudelaire, Mallarmé, Rimbaud and the boys. Comes right down through T.S. Eliot, Allen Ginsberg in the 60s, and all the beat, kind of hate, kind of stuff pouring out. Usually you can see all those guys divided pretty much into two camps. Although that's an oversimplification. Kind of works out that way. I think I'll read one part of the last poem by Tennyson, and if you have anything you want to ask me to read, I'll see if I can grab around here and find it. How's that? Remember the poem Ulysses by Tennyson? Do you remember Ulysses by Homer? A great story, you know, it took him 10 years to get back after the Trojan Wars. Talk about bad wars. Not that there's such a thing as a good war, I guess. But 10 years for him, all for Helen, You know, she must have been quite a woman to have started all that. But anyway, as you remember from his travels, he took him a long time to get back to his home. And along the way, he was washed up, remember, on various islands. Some of it was pretty bad. Some of his men chased, turned into pigs and things. And other times, of course, he had beautiful enchantresses who made his time go a little faster. And it wasn't tough duty all the time he was there. Meanwhile, back at his castle, remember, Penelope was holding off the suitors in the castle. These guys would show up every night and eat all of Ulysses' food and drink his wine and say, Penelope, you must choose a new husband. Now, obviously, Odysseus is not coming back. He's Poseidon has done him under. And his son, Telemachus, was growing up to be a young man. And remember the story that she would always drop? She said, I'll choose a new mate when I finish this weaving. And then she'd go to bed that night and rip out a couple of stitches and come back and say, well, boys, I'm not through yet. This put him off for 10 years. They're a very bright lot, I guess. And anyway, that went on. And then that great, great finish when he finally came back from the seas and walked up, and nobody recognized him, but I think that the old maid by sitting by the fire recognized, touched a scar on him somewhere. And then the old dog, who was 90 years old, he recognized him. And remember this, how it goes. Ulysses took Telemachus aside, who was a big strapping young man at that time, said, listen, I'm your old man, don't you recognize me? And he said, a certain signal, we're gonna do these guys in. So they got their weapons, and a certain signal they did. Penelope was standing up there cheering them on, I suppose. Anyway, all this is a prelude to this poem. When Tennyson came along and picked up the story, he said, surely this is not all, just because it took him 10 years to get back. What else? This guy, the story's over, this great bow-legged warrior. By the way, did you know he was one of the first draft dodgers, that conscientious objectors that we know of? We always think when you read the Iliad and Odyssey, it's the great gangbusters, you know, it's the Greek thing, the woman handing her son the shield, saying, come back carrying it or on it. Very macho. So we think all these heroes, if you remember when they were getting together, the army, to go bring Helen back, he put on a skirt and pretended to be a woman going around, and they said, look at those legs. It looks like Odysseus under that skirt. So, I don't know what the moral of that is, but now that I've got you thinking about that, I'm trying to find this poem. Tennyson picked up the story and said, maybe Ulysses still has something to do, just because he's older now. So the story takes it from that point where he's older and he's standing out by his castle, looking at the ocean, and here it is. Let's just read it's a long poem, and I'm just going to read the last 20 lines or so. But if you can imagine him standing out there, and he says, geez, I'd like to go out and do it again. Push off. So you can see him going down to the local tavern where all the old cronies are. He slaps them on the back and says, boys, you want to set off, sail again? Let's go have another adventure. And now they're getting up in years, and they're saying, what? Are you kidding? I got arthritis and bursitis, and I can't see. And I'm 75 years old, and you want me to set out? He said, come on, it'll be a great adventure. So if you can imagine in your mind, these 8 or 9 guys shouldering, barely, this big long boat, and walking down to the beach. At the same time thinking, why are we doing this? I'd rather be in the sauna or anything, but Ulysses has talked us into it. Well, that's where Tennyson picks up the story of Ulysses. And these are the last 20 lines. Ulysses is trying to crank these guys up for one last thing. There lies the port. The vessel puffs her sail. There gloom the dark, broad seas, my mariners. Souls that have toiled and wrought and thought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome took the thunder and the sunshine and opposed free hearts, free foreheads. You and I are old. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done. Not unbecoming men that strove with gods. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Huzzah! That's great stuff, isn't it? How these guys could resist that. So I don't know where the story goes after Tennyson's. You have to write it yourself, I guess. See, maybe they're still out there sailing around. How about an E.E. Cummings? Do you like Cummings? I just picked up Edna St. Vincent Millay. Do you like Edna St. Vincent Millay instead of Cummings? Whoever I'm reading at the moment is my favorite favorite poet. Edna St. Vincent Millay is better. Here's one, I'll just, random, how's that? Okay, it's a sonnet, these are collected sonnets, and just see how this goes. The doctor asked her what she wanted done with him. They could not lie there many days. And she was shocked to see how life goes on, even after death, in irritating ways. And mused how if he had not died at all, 'twould have been easier. Then there need not be the stiff disorder of a funeral everywhere, and the hideous industry, and crowds of people calling her by name and questioning her she'd never seen before, but only watching by his bed once more, and sitting silent if a knocking came. She said at length, feeling the doctor's eyes, I don't know what you do exactly when a person dies. Edna St. Vincent Millay, yeah, she's awfully good. She's got a couple of sonnets, if I can find them. I'm sure you probably have read them sometime. What Lips My Lips Have Kissed and Where and Why. Do you remember that one? I can never find anything when I want it. And my students, of course, at school, they know that, and they kind of settle back with long sighs and open biology and start to do other things. And I think they're taking down my notes, and they're not. About 5 or 6 years ago, I just come in at the late, a couple of minutes, and I rushed in there and I whipped open my book and I started talking about William Carlos Williams. Remember one of my favorite poems, The Red Wheelbarrow, about that long? It says, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's it. I loved it when the critics got a hold of that. They did a whole big number on that. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. I started talking about William Carlos Williams. He's a pediatrician from Paterson, New Jersey, and that was going on and on and on. I must have been carrying forth about 4 or 5 minutes and ranting and raving. I looked up and a couple of people in the front row were looking at me like that. I thought, gee, I've got them spellbound. And I kept on, and pretty soon a couple more people, and they put their pencils down and looked at me. And finally one girl says, Dr. Ledbetter, where do you think you are? I looked at her and I felt like, I said, where do you think you are? And I said, well, then I thought, where the hell am I? I said, poetry? History. I turned around and the prof who had come in later than I was standing there looking at me. I didn't know. They all looked the same to me. They say the same thing about teachers, I guess. But no, you know, they're so programmed. They started writing down William Carlos Williams. And, well, he's probably here at somebody's behest and going to talk about poetry today.
That wasn't theology.
They would have taken a few notes down before they. Where do you think? It was Smith, Leonard Smith, yeah. Here it is. What lips my lips have kissed, and where and why, I have forgotten. And what arms have lain under my head till morning. But the rain is full of ghosts tonight that tap and sigh upon the glass and listen for reply. And in my heart there stirs a quiet pain for unremembered lads that not again will turn to me at midnight with a cry. Thus in the winter stands the lonely tree, nor knows what birds have vanished one by one, yet knows its boughs more silent than before. I cannot say what loves have come and gone. I only know that summer sang in me a little while that in me sings no more. It's good, isn't she? The same prophet in Nebraska who told me that Longfellow was passé also skipped over this woman. I had troubles with this guy from that point on. Especially, I was doing my dissertation on Mark Van Doren. And he didn't like Mark Van Doren. He thought Mark Van Doren, he said, quote, was a second-rate poet and a third-rate critic. It's a bad thing to tell an Irish poet who likes Mark Van Doren. We had a good time. Okay. Here's one just at random. Oh, you will be sorry for that word. Give back my book and take my kiss instead. Was it my enemy or my friend I heard? What a big book for such a little head. Come, I will show you now my newest hat, and you may watch me purse my mouth and prink. Oh, I shall love you still and all of that. I never again shall tell you what I think. I shall be sweet and crafty, soft and sly. You will not catch me reading anymore. I shall be called a wife to pattern by. And someday when you knock and push the door, some sane day, not too bright and not too stormy, I shall be gone, and you may whistle for me. Okay, do you have anybody? I was going to read you one by E.E. Cummings, wasn't I? Can I start for that? You like Cummings? He's pretty good, isn't he? Cummings is one of the few experimenters in poetry. It's hard to be an experimenter in poetry. There have only been three or four. Gerard Manley Hopkins, Cummings, and a few others. It's just hard to do anything with words. Cat is cat, C-A-T. Dog, what do you do with that? Cummings at least puts asterisks and half parentheses marks, and when he writes grasshopper, he'll have it hop off the page. But that's about it. That's kind of artsy, craftsy. It's hard to, if you're working with the plastic arts and you're a painter or whatever, you can do all kinds of things, manipulate your material. But if you're a writer, you just write. That's why experiments in poetry usually don't turn out well. And there haven't been a whole bunch of guys who've been successful. Walt Whitman in his line, the great Sears and Roebuck catalog line, is successful, but everybody, that's been done. So Cummings is an experimenter. Here's a poem called May I Feel, said he. May I feel, said he, I'll squeal, said she. Just once, said he, it's fun, said she. May I touch, said he, how much, said she. A lot, said he, why not, said she. Let's go, said he, not too far, said she. What's too far, said he, where you are, said she. May I stay, said he, which way, said she. Like this, said he, if you kiss, said she. May I move, said he, is it love, said she. If you're willing, said he, and you're killing, said she. But it's life, said he, but your wife, said she. Now, said he, ow, said she. Tip top, said he, don't stop, said she. Oh no, said he, go slow, said she. Said he, said she. You're divine, said he, and you are mine, said she. Yeah, Cummings is good, isn't he? Do you know Buffalo Bill's defunct? I don't think it's in this book. Buffalo Bill's defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? Cummings is very good. He writes really good sonnets, all kinds of neat stuff. Okay, what would you like me to read? Anything in particular?
Do you have more Frost there? I wonder if you have two tramps in one time.
I might. Probably. I'll tell you what, I'll give you the book and you find it. How's that? And I'll just read something else.
Did you have Cummings, anyone lived in a pretty hometown?
Yeah, sure. When? Is that it, the first line? When? Is there another first line on it? Cummings has great titles. Here's a title, My Girl's Tall with Hard, Long Eyes. Just great titles he had. It's like Whitman. Whitman's got the greatest titles. When Lilacs Last and the Dooryard Bloomed. Great, beautiful titles. Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Rocking. Super titles. Did you find it?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me see if I can find this.
You can read this in the hurdle for that one.
Hi, George. I think you caught on there. How it works. Wait one second. I thought I just saw it. May I feel, said he. Read that twice. I read that at an elder hostel. You know what elder hostel is? Just 2 weeks ago. And I thought those ladies would come right out of their chairs. I loved it. I screamed. That led to about 15 minutes of the raunchiest stories and poems and jokes I ever read. It was super. I didn't know what to expect. Elder hostels are neat things. Well, this is a long poem. Okay. Two tramps in mud time. This is Robert Frost. Out of the mud, two strangers came and caught me splitting wood in the yard. And one of them put me off my aim by hailing cheerily, "Hit him hard!" I knew pretty well why he dropped behind and let the other go in a way. I knew pretty well what he had in mind. He wanted to take my job for pay. Good blocks of oak it was I split, as large around as the chopping block. And every piece I squarely hit fell splinterless as a cloven rock. The blows that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good that day, giving to a loose to my soul, I spent on the unimportant wood. The sun was warm, but the wind was chill. You know how it is on an April day. When the sun is out and the wind is still, you're 1 month on in the middle of May. But if you so much as dare to speak, a cloud comes over the sunlit arch, a wind comes off a frozen peak, and you're 2 months back in the middle of March. A bluebird comes tenderly up to alight and turns to the wind to unruffle a plume, his song so pitched as not to excite a single flower as yet to bloom. It is snowing a flake, and he half knew winter was only playing possum. Except in color he isn't blue, but he wouldn't advise a thing to blossom. The water for which we may have to look in summertime with a witching wand, in every wheel rut's now a brook, in every print of a hoof a pond. Be glad of water, but don't forget the lurking frost in the earth beneath that will steal forth after the sun is set and show on the water its crystal teeth. The time when most I loved my task, these two must make me love it more by coming with what they came to ask. You'd think I never had felt before the weight of an axe head poised aloft, the grip on earth of outspread feet, the life of muscles rocking soft and smooth and moist in vernal heat. Out of the woods, two hulking tramps, from sleeping God knows where last night, but not long since in the lumber camps. They thought all chopping was theirs of right. Men of the woods and lumberjacks, they judged me by their appropriate tool. Except as a fellow handled an axe, they had no way of knowing a fool. Nothing on either side was said. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head, as that I had no right to play with what was another man's work for gain. My right might be love, but theirs was need. And where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right, agreed. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes. Okay. Got time? Did you find it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Oh, In Just Spring?
Yeah.
You know that poem? In Just Spring? If you ever get a chance to hear Cummings read this on a record, what a wild reader he is. He just sounds pretty bizarre. Sort of like, who's the guy that wrote The Congo? Part of the Midwest Chicago Renaissance with Carl Sandburg. Anyway, they're both really bizarre readers. And Cummings reads this so well. Anyway, it's called In Just Spring. In just spring, when the world is mud luscious, the little lame balloon man whistles far and wee, and Eddie and Bill come running from marbles and piracies, and it's spring. When the world is puddle wonderful, the queer old balloon man whistles far and wee, and Betty and Isabel come dancing from hopscotch and jump rope, and it's spring. And the goat-footed balloon man whistles. Anyone lived in a pretty high town with up so floating many bells down, spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't, he danced his did. Women and men, both little and small, cared for anyone not at all. They sowed their isn't, they reaped their same, sun, moon, stars, rain. Children guessed, but only a few, and down they forgot as up they grew, autumn, winter, spring, summer, that no one loved him more by more, when by now and tree, tree by leaf, she laughed his joy, she cried his grief. Bird by snow and stir by still, anyone's any was all to her. Some ones married their everyone's, laughed their cryings and did their dance. Sleep, wake, hope, and then they said their nevers, they slept their dream. Stars, rain, sun, moon, and only the snow can begin to explain how children are apt to forget to remember with up so floating many bells down. One day anyone died, I guess, and no one stooped to kiss his face. Busy folk buried them side by side, little by little and was by was. All by all and deep by deep, and more by more they dreamed their sleep. No one and anyone, earth by April, wish by spirit and if by yes. Women and men, both dong and ding, summer, autumn, winter, spring, reap their sowing and what theirs came, sun, moon, stars, rain. Okay, got time for one more. Anything particular you'd like? Haven't had any Emily Dickinson.
James Russell Lowell, Personal Fault.
Oh, I knew somebody would ask me for something I didn't have. Nope, I don't have that. I've got that in a bigger book. It's probably at the library. I'll try to maybe get that out next time. You know, it's a beautiful poem. I knew I wouldn't have them all. How about a couple of real fast Emily Dickinson's? Mm-hmm. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. That's all you need of that poem, isn't it? That's brilliant. Anybody can write that. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple hosts who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated dying on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear. I think we better let you go. It's about that time. Thanks.